upcoming local council elections for the Green Party and is rushed off her feet with campaigning, as well as her paid employment and enforced rabbit-caring duties. I always knew I would be absent throughout the campaign due to this walk, but I feel more than a pang of guilt listening to her trying to be interested as I waffle on about overpriced soap and not seeing any basking sharks. I want to tell her that I miss her, and that I wish I was there to help her, and that above all else. I am so unwaveringly proud of her for having the courage to stand up and fight for what she believes in. Instead, I think I say something about the nice man in the B&B murdering me with lentil moussaka. The next morning at breakfast, I meet the inhabitants of the other guest bedroom. A pleasant couple somewhere around middle age, both with an enthusiasm for Weetabix that rivals my own. This momentarily phases the chatty owners as we advise them we won't require any cooked breakfast, but do you have any more of the aforementioned wheat-based treats? The woman is German and is therefore able to answer a question for me that has been bubbling under the surface for some time. I've noticed over the last week or so that there seems to be a disproportionate number of German, or at least German-speaking, walkers on the path. She tells me that there is a long-running TV programme in Germany that is set in and shot on the South Cornwall coast. The show is hugely popular amongst a certain demographic, and every year hundreds of fans flock to the UK in pilgrimage, just to catch sight of the locations they've been watching on TV. She is keen to point out that she thinks the programme is a load of old tosh. Armed with this new knowledge and full to bursting with Weetabix goodness, I say my goodbyes and set off for today's 14-mile trek to Meyavagissey. After an uneventful trek back to the coast of a mile or so, I pick up the path coming out of Port Lou. The day is warm and close, but there are storms brewing over the ocean as layers of dark clouds gather and begin to rumble. The sea itself is too calm for there not to be something major in the offing. It has turned an almost smoky grey-blue colour, and its silence is deafening. Even the gulls are keeping their beaks shut as they glide overhead. There appears a purposefulness to their flight that leads me to believe they are hastily heading for cover. The path is rocky and undulating, and by the time the first drops of rain land on my skin, they are mingled with a layer of sweat. As I approach Hemick Beach, the climbs become tougher and steeper, and the skies darker as the storm intensifies. There are occasional flashes of neon, jagged lightning on the horizon where sea meets sky. The scene is so staggeringly beautiful, I feel as though I might explode. The power and grandeur of nature creates the sensation that I'm at the edge of everything that has ever been. The very beginning or the very end of time, of life, of all. Then, a short while later, as I approach Dodman Point, the storm stops dead. The thunder and lightning vanish, taking the rain with them, and the clouds part to reveal the warm, bright sun smiling behind them. With this new clarity appears some fantastic views in every direction as the path continues to wind dramatically onwards. The silence has been broken out at sea as well, as the constant lapping of the waves underpins the squawks of the newly confident gulls. The speed at which the scene before me has altered gives the storm a forgotten, dreamlike quality, and I momentarily wonder if it really even happened. Over the next few miles, the walking continues to be challenging, but with consistent visual payoffs. Then, as I reach Goran Haven, where I'll stop for lunch, I have to negotiate some road walking. When faced with these occasional, unwelcome forays onto the tarmac, where boredom and peril collide, I tend to switch off and run on autopilot. A few minutes in, and I realise I'm chanting something over and over again under my breath, as though I'm repeating a mantra. Boots, 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 boots. Stick 'em on your boot stumps, boots. I don't know if this is a thing amongst all walkers, or a peculiarity singular to my increasingly fragile brain, but I've noticed it a good deal recently. A few random lines get stuck in my head, and subconsciously I spend hours just quietly repeating them over and over again. It can be a song lyric, or in some cases a new idea for my aforementioned album of rambling classics. I'm currently working on a version of Going Loco Down in Acapulco by the Four Tops, or was it Phil Collins? Doesn't matter. It goes, going coastal down in... That's where it stops, as I've yet to pass through anywhere that sounds like Acapulco. Fingers crossed. The other day, for example, I was inadvertently repeating the phrase, in spite of what you've been told about Elvis, the good die old and helpless. Which is, of course, the opening line from a classic Carter USM song. If you're out walking in the middle of nowhere and you pass by some leathery-looking chap on his own chanting, in spite of what you've been told about Elvis, the good die old and helpless, over and over again, well, it'll give you a pretty sizeable case of the spooks, to say the least. Especially in the unlikely event that you aren't up to speed with the back catalogue of the greatest rock and roll band in musical history. I take a mental note to make a conscious effort to keep this new habit in check from here on in. Sometime later, and the path has flattened out as I begin the long approach to Chapel Point. The views are mesmerising, as they've been all day, and in the warm afternoon sunshine, my face resumes the look of smug contentment that it has had for so much of this adventure so far. As I slowly descend through rolling green farmland, the buildings that populate Chapel Point come into view. A small group of white 1930s-style houses clumped together in this idyllic and isolated spot. It's duly added to the ever-growing list of places along this coastline that I'm definitely going to live in when a sack of money falls from the sky into my lap. I pass through the attractive Port Mellon Beach, littered with families out exploring rock pools and chomping ice creams. Then my destination for the day at last appears in the distance. Mevagissey, not Megavissey, as I'm continually referring to it, is a pretty and busy fishing village complete with working harbour and typical picture postcard Cornish cottages. I'm booked into a hotel that sits atop a hill way above the village, with its bustling narrow streets. Once I've checked in and showered, I explore the crowded alleyways in search of sustenance. I eventually settle for a chippy by the harbour side and sit on a bench overlooking the sea. I share my meal with a grateful and somewhat shabby-looking gull. When we're both full, we sit and watch the world go by for a while in the fading light. The following morning, I'm sat in the classy, period-decor dining room of the hotel, chewing happily on the old bits of wheat. I glance up and notice that the male half of the couple sat two tables along from mine is Shaking Stevens. Now, I know what you're thinking, dear reader. Come on, Reynolds, I hear you cry. Are you expecting us to believe that you've seen Enfield and Stevens on the same trip? To which I reply, don't forget the cafe in St. Ives, where I may or may not have been sitting within reach of a former Blue Peter presenter. We need to talk about Rowley. I'm packing up my kit a short while later and decide I can no longer ignore the inconvenient truth. This latest regeneration of my earnest walking companion is a touch left field for my palate. Quick referencing no longer seems possible as he rumbles endlessly on with detailed history lessons and nearby sites of interest. Worst of all, the sections are no longer split into day-length walks. What all of this means, dear reader, is that I have to think for myself. To quote Woodhouse, this leaves me, if not absolutely disgruntled, then certainly a good deal less than gruntled. I eye him disapprovingly and shove him into a side pocket in my backpack. I can only hope he comes to his senses sooner rather than later, because I'm not an idiot, as you know, and as it stands, he's of no more use to me than my tent, sleeping bag, roll mat and... well, let's just say the vast majority of things I'm hauling around on my back. The weather is warm but drizzly as I leave Mevagissey. The first signs of just how tough today's 17-mile hike to Foy is going to arrive within minutes. Viciously steep climbs in quick succession leave me struggling for breath before my Weetabix have even settled. The sweeping views of undulating hills stretching off into the distance bring with them the realization that these sharp ascents and descents are going to be the predominant feature of the day. A few miles in, I encounter a small group of half a dozen or so sheep. They are clearly escapees from a nearby farm, now perched precariously on the cliff edge, chomping merrily away on the forbidden flora. I try to edge past them without spooking them. This doesn't work, and as soon as they spy me, they scarper off along the path. For the following 30 minutes, I'm essentially shepherding them along the narrow, winding track. I try to appeal to their sense of reason. "Look, just let me pass, you idiots. I have no desire to be arrested for livestock theft." This falls on deaf ears, and I'm starting to contemplate the idea of arriving in Foy this afternoon with a small flock of sheep in tow, when the path finally widens. This empowers them to pluck up enough courage to stand, trembling in a small clearing, and let me pass. To the nearby farmer missing half a dozen of their sheep, "I'm sorry. I did everything I could under the circumstances." Shortly thereafter, the path is becoming rockier and even more exhausting. The views onto Charlestown are outstanding through the continued light drizzle. As I reach the stunning Blackhead Rock, a buzzard circles overhead, and I allow myself 5 minutes to watch in awe as the graceful bird soars, hovers, and swoops in search of a spot of brunch. Blackhead is the site of an old Iron Age fort, and is a perfect example of this stretch of coastline at its very best. I continue on my way into Charlestown, where I stop for a very welcome lunch. This attractive town is rich in history, with beautiful old-fashioned ships anchored in its authentic harbour. It was also used as a location to film the famous motion picture, The Eagle Has Landed. So plenty for me to mull over as I wolf down the old MB. Any hopes I had of an easier afternoon are soon dashed as I enter a section of path referred to locally as the Cornish Alps. The views are as stunning as the walking is back-breaking. By the time I reach Par and the impressive Par Sands beach, I'm very nearly spent. An inland section follows as I negotiate the River Par. On this occasion, I'm glad of it, as it brings with it a mercifully flat stretch of path that follows a local cycle track. This turns out to be relatively short-lived, however, and the rocky climbs soon resume. Rising to wind-swept headlands and descending down through rich woodland into picturesque hidden coves. I pass the striking red and white striped tower at Gribbin Head. I have no idea what it is or was used for, but it's a pretty, if a slightly comical, addition to the luscious coastline in this section. I continue past a beach marked as private. This section of the south coast has many such private beaches. It's a concept alien to me. I didn't realise you could even own a beach. It doesn't sit easy with me, if I'm being honest, but on this occasion it does bring with it a family of swans relaxing at the water's edge. I stand and watch them for a few minutes before dragging my aching legs onwards. I reach Foy, utterly exhausted with the rain still drizzling down as it has been all day. I'm booked into a pub, sat on the harbour side for the evening. The bustling town gives me a strong sense of déjà vu, so similar is the scene to that of the previous evening, albeit on a larger scale. There can be no doubt that holiday season is now in full swing, as each location I arrive at is full to the brim with happy tourists, lapping up the delights of these Cornish coastal resorts. So tired am I from the day's exertions that the evening is spent in the pub below my room, sipping the local ale, writing up my notes from the last few days and chatting to the friendly bar staff. They tell me about some of the places I'll walk through over the next couple of days, and I go to bed, tipsy with excitement for what lies ahead. As I set off the next morning, the sun is bright and warm, and the 12-mile walk to Loo promises much. The day begins with another ferry crossing from Foy to Polruan. Whilst I'm waiting, I get chatting to a chap who's about to be picked up for work. He's a construction worker and is initially bewildered and a touch derogatory when I tell him about the journey I've embarked on. By the time his lift arrives, however, he concedes that he wishes he was coming with me and shakes me by the hand before being driven away. I briefly contemplate the reactions I've had from the many folks I've met along the way. It can be said that there is rarely a middle ground. Either they think I'm a total moron for voluntarily walking 630 miles on my own when there are perfectly good public transport options available, or they're jealous of the adventure I'm on and wish they could join me on it. It seems it's either your idea of heaven or hell. As the small boat that is to ferry me across the river pulls up alongside me, I'm in no doubt. I wouldn't swap this adventure for all the package holidays to Mallorca, stag weekends in Ibiza, or gap years in Thailand that money can buy. The next stretch from Polruan to Polperro is across land owned by the National Trust. This usually suggests some quality walking and scenery are in the offing. I'm not disappointed, as I instantly pick up where I left off the previous day, with spectacular views as the single-track path winds its way around and over dramatic rocky cliffs and through secluded woody coves. So spectacular are the views here that I can just make out the Lizard in one direction. It feels like so long ago I was there, and the sight of it brings with it a wave of nostalgia. I stop this in its tracks pretty quick sharpish, however, deciding it more worthwhile to focus on what's ahead of me rather than behind me. I spy an impressive natural rock arch sticking out to sea over the cliff edge and stop to take a few pictures of it. As I do this, a rabbit appears from a nearby clump of shrubbery and sits on the path in front of me. These cuddly, destructive furballs have been a consistent addition to the landscape over the last few days. This one, however, bears all the telltale signs of that most vile of human-introduced diseases, myxomatosis. I've dreaded this situation. Do I have the courage to put the creature out of its undoubted misery? As I watch its emaciated frame limp blindly around in search of food, I know that I must. I pick up a suitably sized rock and attempt to creep up on it. As I do this, it hears me, hops into the shrubbery on the cliff edge, and disappears. I'm saddened and relieved in equal measure. As I carry on towards Polperro, the animal encounters continue thick and fast. Fields full of sheep and cows pass by in the sweltering May sunshine. When walking, I'm always nervous of large groups of cows. Such placid, peaceful creatures, you may say. To which I reply, "That's all well and good, dear reader, but you try being chased from numerous fields by gangs of the boisterous little blighters." True, this only generally occurs when it's a field of young, inquisitive males. Nonetheless, it leaves its mark on even the bravest of handsome explorers, such as yours truly. So it's with a tiptoeing caution that I pass these bovine obstacles. As with the previous few days, the path mixes open, rocky cliff-top walking with stretches of dense, rich woodland. After emerging from one such stretch, I begin the approach to the idyllic village of Polperro. I pass a striking First World War memorial during my descent. Polperro shares its basic traits with the majority of Cornish harbour villages I've passed through since Land's End, but it's a particularly pretty example of such. I make my way through the crowds of tourists that fill its steep, narrow walkways. Once I've reached the other side and the crowds have cleared, I pick a spot and stop for lunch. Unwrapping the MB of the day, I sit and watch the sea gently lap at the shoreline below me. The gulls begin to eye me excitedly from above, and when they start circling closer, I take it as a sign and get on my way. Everybody likes Mars bars. More steep climbs follow, and I'm again struggling by the time I reach Talland Bay. The church on one side of the bay is arrestingly placed for maximum effect. I use this as an excuse to rest up for a few minutes and sit taking in the vista. imagining how dramatic this scene would look on a dark, stormy evening. From here on, the remaining few miles to Loo are a bit easier on the old leg muscles. I've booked into a cheap hotel for the night, something I'm exceptionally grateful for, as the recent hike in prices is doing some serious damage to my daily budget, and the prospect of the canvas is once again looming. The town of Loo is split into two very distinctive sections, West Loo and East Loo. My hotel is in the former, which appears to be the quieter of the two, with the main town itself being in East Loo. My hotel stands out amongst the posh B&Bs, guest houses and more upmarket hotels that adorn the streets along the promenade. If it was in Shoreditch, it would be called shabby chic. It isn't, though. In Shoreditch, I mean. It's in West Loo. I arrive at reception and ring the bell. A small King Charles Spaniel appears in answer to my call and lies down on its back in front of me, awaiting the presumed belly rub. From this moment on, I fall in love with the place. Its Kubrick-esque decor wins me over. 1970s-style paintings of glamorous women in pastel colours adorn the walls, and I think the carpet actually is the same as the one in The Shining. After a while, the proprietor arrives and affords me a friendly welcome. A tall man, in large, square, orange-tinted spectacles and a green polo shirt, proudly emblazoned with the hotel's name. He is as eccentric as his domain suggests, and mentions the hotel's excellent balcony and garden facilities at least 20 times whilst showing me to my room. I tell him I'm in love with his dog, and he replies that everybody is. She's a tart, but I'm fond of her. After unpacking, I leave my room to discover the dog sitting patiently outside my door. As soon as she sees me, she rolls over again, expectantly. You really are a tart, I say, as I make a fuss of her. I take the 15-minute walk along the quayside into East Loo for dinner. After dining on a cheese and jalapeno wrap and chips, I really need to work on the diet. I return to the hotel and make my way to the bar. There are a few other guests dotted around as I take a seat by the window. Soon the proprietor, who seems to run the place single-handed, reappears and takes my drinks order. He chats enthusiastically to all the guests, myself included, and tells me again about the balcony and garden facilities. I duly retire, drink in hand, to the much-hyped balcony area, where I lazily sit and look out to sea. For the record, it is a lovely balcony. This cannot be denied. The next morning at breakfast, again served by the proprietor himself, I'm consulting Rowley regards the day ahead. A short 8-mile jaunt to the excellently named Port Wrinkle. I'm chuckling to myself, mainly at the word wrinkle, when the proprietor materialises beside me with a small silver tray filled with dairy triangles. I look at him, obviously visibly confused. For your toast? Oh, I see. No, that's fine, thanks. I'll just be having some Weetabix. I can see he is hurt by this news. Are you sure? We have a full cooked breakfast on the menu. You can eat it on the balcony if you like, or in the garden. No, that's fine, thank you very much, though. He is still looking crestfallen, and in the end, not wanting to hurt the man's feelings, we agree on a compromise, and I take a dairy lead triangle. It's with some regret that I leave the hotel behind me and set off on my way. You would struggle to find a more welcoming and enjoyable place to stay in this part of the world. I vow to leave a good review on TripAdvisor as I begin the day's walk with a stroll back through East Loo and into the woodlands beyond it. The day is blisteringly hot, and so the shade of the trees is a welcome start. I pass through Millendreath village as the views open up. A handful of the customary steep climbs follow soon after, before I reach the heights of the impressive Bodiga Cliffs. An area of coastal erosion means I'm diverted inland for a stretch. This leads down some pleasant country lanes before I rejoin the path again. I see a group of gliders ahead of me and stop for lunch to watch them in flight. The participants are clearly reveling in the experience on a clear, hot day over the sparkling sea. I watch as the gulls give them a wide berth whilst eyeing them curiously. Once I've consumed the good old rations, I apply generous amounts of pseudocreme to my ankles, shoulders and a few of my more personal areas. I apologise for so abruptly bringing down the tone, dear reader, but I feel it's important I relay to you the complete experience, warts and all. Please note, I don't have warts in any areas, personal or otherwise. The rise in temperature, coupled with the sustained tough walking of the last week or so, have brought with them a good deal of unwelcome chafing. The path continues to undulate until I reach the Batten Cliffs, which Rowley advises, I can't stay mad at him, are some of the highest on the south coast. I can see the path continuing along the cliff top in front of me and carry on with a spring in my step. The walking here is fantastic. The bright sunshine, clear blue skies, and reflective beauty of the ocean below leave me in an almost meditative state. The gulls swoop silently above me, and for the first time today, there is not another soul in sight. I walk through some small residential areas and have the sense of stepping back in time. Tiny, seemingly deserted hamlets that would have looked almost identical 100 years ago to how they do today. As today's walk is only 8 miles long, I'm soon approaching Port Wrinkle. I look at my notes and see that my hotel is on Finnegook Lane. Nearby on the map is the small village of Crafthole. I'm staying on Finnegook Lane in Port Wrinkle, just outside Crafthole. Perhaps I've been alone too long, but this is all too much for me, and I'm overcome with fits of laughter. After calming down, I decide that I will definitely start using the word Crafthole as a derogatory term. You are a complete Crafthole. That guy, oh, he's a total Crafthole. That sort of thing. I'm staying at the only hotel in Port Wrinkle. It's a Victorian building on a grand old scale and is full to the brim with holidaymakers. This is fairly surreal, as the rest of this sleepy spot is empty and the hotel is a sharp contrast to the isolation of the last few hours. Yours truly is once again in the bargain backpacker's room, tucked safely away from the rest of the guests. My budget won't stretch to a meal at the hotel's restaurant, and so I wander down the beach to a small hut I passed on the way in, serving chips, which makes a nice change. That night, I'm sat in my room contemplating the next few days. My old mate, Mickey B, is going to come out and meet me in Plymouth to walk a day or two with me. However, I've mistimed my arrival to the city, and as a result, am faced with the prospect of 3 nights there. Mickey B has already booked his B&B and is travelling a fair old distance to visit me, so there's no scope for changing the arrangements. Worse things have happened at sea, but nevertheless, I'm not looking forward to being off the trail for so long. I set off early the following morning for the 15-mile walk to Plymouth. Rowley seems to suggest that the walk is a fairly moderate one. As I say, he's not as direct as he once was, but this seems to be what he's getting at. Before I even leave Port Wrinkle, I'm faced with crossing a golf course. Have I mentioned I'm not a huge fan? Thankfully, golfers as a breed are legendarily lazy by nature, and so I'm past the course before any of them have so much as brushed their teeth. If they even brush their teeth, probably not. Golfers as a breed have notoriously bad teeth. I've also heard it was golfers that introduced grey squirrels into our countryside and in doing so wiped out the native red squirrel. Don't shoot the messenger. I'm just telling you what I've heard. Note, golfers did not introduce grey squirrels to the UK. Or did they? No. After negotiating the golf course, I'm faced with a military firing range. The red flags are flying, which means I must spend the next few miles walking on a pavement by the side of a road. I've heard that the number one leisure pursuit for retired members of the armed forces is golf. This isn't as unpleasant as it could be, as I still enjoy great views out to sea, and the earlier hour means next to no traffic on the road. Plus, I use this time to work on my album of walking classics. Porthcurno almost works. Going loco down in Porthcurno. I've been gone too long. when I return to the coast, the path delivers the first inspired stretch of walking of the day. Apart from a number of unattractive clusters of mobile holiday homes, the views are spectacular and the trail is winding and challenging. I'm joined by large numbers of crows who seem to have wrestled control of this stretch of coastline from the usually dominant gulls. They gracefully glide beside me, just out to sea, occasionally disappearing from view below the cliff edge. The sticky heat has brought with it armies of bugs that buzz around me in swarms like living clouds. Every now and then, one will fly, kamikaze style, into my eye or mouth, and I spend a good deal of time rubbing my eyes and spluttering. I pass over the beautiful and seemingly endless Whitsand Bay. This whole area is adorned with Dartmoor ponies, grazing on the hillsides and strolling past with no interest in me whatsoever. Next, I reach Rame Head and stop to sit a while and drink in the views out across the deep blue sea. The flowers are out in force, dotted all over the rocky landscape and completing the rich, warm summer feel of the day. After about 10 minutes, I decide to plough on, as it would be very easy to nod off here, and I've still got a fair few miles ahead of me. From there on in, the path starts to get a good deal less rugged. After rounding Rame Head, I'm on the approach to Plymouth, and passing through areas of managed woodland and park. The path becomes decidedly manicured, and more people begin to appear with pushchairs and picnic baskets, enjoying the glorious sunshine. The spectre of Plymouth is soon visible in the distance ahead, a vast, smoking metropolis through an increasingly thick, muggy heat haze. It's a strange sight. I live in a city, probably 5 times the size of Plymouth, and yet, at this moment, it could be London or New York. It's far and away the largest urban expanse I've seen in the last 6 weeks, and I would be lying if I said it was anything other than a completely unwelcome sight. As I get ever nearer to the sprawling concrete jungle, I'm hit by the feeling of walking back to reality. I've not been in anything approaching real isolation since arriving on the south coast. But Plymouth is not a holiday town or pretty fishing village. It's a real city where people live out their lives working in offices and shops, where there is homelessness and decay, cinemas and bowling alleys, where there are fights outside pubs and parking tickets, where there are double bacon cheeseburgers and pound shops. In short, the real world, where I live, work in an office, eat double bacon cheeseburgers, and go to the cinema. Eventually, I reach Coal Sand, where I catch the ferry across into Plymouth itself. It's hot and densely populated, but, in truth, far from being the ugliest of cities. My hotel is a trendy, converted townhouse that is affordable, mainly because it's only just opened. I check into the room that I'll spend the next 3 nights in and attempt to formulate a plan to see me through until I can rejoin the trail. There is a stretch of the coast path itself that goes through the city centre. So if I walk that tomorrow, then when Mickey B arrives we won't need to spend any time in the city and can pick up the trail from the other side of Plymouth. There's also all the usual laundry and stocking up of supplies to be done. Lastly, I have some friends who live in nearby Totnes. I planned to meet up with them a week or so from now when I'm passing through Brixham, so it seems sensible to see if they're about and pay them a visit over the next few days as well. It's all starting to sound manageable, and my spirits are rising. I make the call and arrange to catch the train to Totnes and meet them tomorrow. I then call the folks, Tasha and my brother, before heading out to grab some food. Sophie and Dan are a couple that used to live near us in Bristol. They were good friends of ours until they decided to betray us forever by upping sticks and moving to the countryside, thereby leaving us to fend for ourselves and revealing themselves to be selfish, mean-spirited people who probably now play golf. Sophie used to work with Tasha, which is how we all met. Dan used to be a chef, and now, together, they run their own successful bakery in Totnes. It's called the Almond Thief, and you should all go and visit it, as it's ruddy marvellous. Although, As I say, they are the type of people that leave their friends for dead at the drop of a hat, award-winning sourdough loaves notwithstanding. It's great to catch up with them, and their young son Ezra, who may have spent his entire life coping with being named Moses were it not for yours truly, but that's another story. We have a few beers, Dan cooks a fantastic barbecue, and I then share with them my 500 photographs of the sea. I also get to meet Sophie's mum, who they're currently sharing a house with, and her beautiful and soppy old sheepdog, Bill. We agree some vague plans to meet up again in a few days' time when I reach the Brixham area, and a thoroughly good time is had by all. The second day in Plymouth is spent walking the urban stretch of the coast path across the city. Halfway round, I buy lunch and spend a pleasant hour or so basking in the sun on the common by the lighthouse, looking out to sea. This is followed in the afternoon by the laundrette and food shopping. The day is rounded off by a visit to a Mexican restaurant, followed by the quietest pub I could find. All in all, being stranded in Plymouth isn't as terrible as it first appeared. That being said, I'm foaming at the mouth to get out of the ruddy place and back to the coast path. With Plymouth comes the passing from South Cornwall to South Devon. When I get going again tomorrow, I'll be back in the county where it all began. Apart from I won't, because the path technically starts in Somerset, which ruins that previous sentence, which is a shame, because it was a great sentence, full of atmosphere and meaning. A really good way to end this section. Shame. Chapter 4. South and East Devon. Vegetarians from Barnsley, luxury spa retreats, and Pop's swan song. I arrive at Plymouth coach station to meet Mickey B a full hour early the following day. I'm brimming with excitement at the prospect of getting back on the trail. He's not arriving until late morning, so we've got a short 8-mile trek planned to Wembury, where I'll find a campsite and he'll catch the bus back to his B&B in Plymouth. He'll then get the first bus back to Wembury the following day to meet me, walk half the day's hike with me, and then head back to Wembury to get the bus back to Plymouth again. Yes, I know. I've had 3 nights in Plymouth to reach the conclusion that between the two of us, we, maybe, could have planned this better. Eventually I spy his smiling, baldy northern head from the window of an arriving coach. Mickey B is an old and dear friend whom I first met when we worked together many years ago down in Brighton. He and his equally lovely but much less northern partner, Hayley, have recently moved to Bristol, just down the road from us, in fact. When I first knew him, he was a techno-loving clubber in his early 30s who loved a drink or five. Today, he's a teetotal vegetarian in his 40s who loves a lime cordial, as long as it's a half. Time, a cruel and fickle mistress. Of course I'm one to talk. I'm an ale drinker on a walking holiday. It catches up with us all, dear reader. We greet each other with much cordiality, and I thank him sincerely for taking the trouble to come all that way to walk with me. It's a joy to see the old codger again. The first stretch of the day's walk is urban and unpleasant, as we negotiate our way through the east side of Plymouth. We cross the bridge at Billicombe Road, alongside the constant stream of traffic, and on through Oriston, where we get lost several times. Eventually we arrive at the attractive but absolutely heaving harbour development in the run-up to Mount Batten Point. We stop at a pub overlooking the water for a lavish Sunday roast with all the trimmings. Well, I do. Mickey B's plate consists mainly of broccoli and swede, I think. Then, with our bellies suitably inflated, we push on. There is a complicated bit of navigation soon afterwards where we lose the waymarkers for a spell. I then spot one over the other side of the road, and we appear to pass through the tricky patch unscathed. A short while on, and Rowley is causing me confusion. We should have passed Mount Batten Tower by now, and our direction of travel doesn't make sense against what I'm looking at on the map. I consult Mickey B, and he stares at me questioningly. "Yeah, well, we missed that bit out, didn't we?" he says, pointing at Mount Batten Point on the map. "What do you mean?" I ask, trying to remain cool and collected. Yeah, back there when it got confusing, you spotted the sign at the other side of the road and we picked it up, skipping this loop out here. I looked back at him in astonishment. Why didn't you say something? Oh, I thought it were deliberate. I thought you knew. So there it is, dear reader, a half a mile stretch of the southwest coast path that I missed out. All the times in my future when I tell people I've walked the whole of this mammoth trail, I will, in fact, be lying. All thanks to a teetotal vegetarian from Barnsley. And if you're reading this thinking that it sounds like it was me that picked the wrong route, and it's therefore my fault, well, you can shut up as well, you idiot. The sun is beating down on us as we finally leave the urban sprawl behind us and reach open fields. The path winds gently up and down for a long stretch with no major climbs to tire us out. We pass the time by chatting about everything from the footy results to house prices in the southwest. Inevitably, I spend a good deal of time telling stories from the trip so far, the best sections of walking, the places I've stayed and the people I've met. Eventually, talk turns to my diet. I may, from time to time, throw the odd gentle jest in Mickey B's direction, re the old zero-flesh lifestyle choice. The truth is, however, that his decision to be a vegetarian is based on strong and sound ethical grounds and is to be admired. For my part, I've always made a point of attempting to limit my meat consumption to free-range products. And here we get to the nub of the issue. I've been merrily chomping on processed sausage snacks, dodgy burgers and cheap chicken wraps, no pun intended, throughout the whole walk so far. Upon hearing this, my old friend, with no more than an understated but stern raise of the eyebrow, conveys that this makes me a hypocritical, low-life douchebag with the murderous morals of a fascist war criminal. A smidge strong, perhaps, but I'm suitably ashamed and vow to address the situation. The going continues to be gentle and relatively flat. This is fortunate, as I'm remembering very clearly now what the major issue is with going walking with Mickey B. He moves at 40 million miles an hour. He is an experienced long-distance walker and, fueled by all those cauliflowers and mange too, he is a man on a mission. I repeatedly point out to him that I'm carrying a backpack heavier than an articulated lorry, but he only seems to be able to retain this information for about 3 minutes at a time. This elaborate routine continues past the pretty bays of Jenny Cliff, Leek Bed and Crown Hill, as the sea remains silent, and still in the hot afternoon sunshine, I point out, subtly and breezily, of course, that this easy flat walking is not indicative of the trail as a whole. I wouldn't want there to be any confusion regards the level of heroism I've displayed to get this far. Somewhere past the beautiful Wembury Point, we stop for some liquid refreshment at a pub just off the trail. Whilst there, we get chatting to a family on the table next to ours. "How come you're carrying a bag the size of a house and he's only got a tiny little rucksack?" one of their number inquires. "He's from Barnsley," I quip, cleverly inventing a new and baseless stereotype in the process. After the exchanging of a few more pleasantries, I reveal that I've not yet booked anywhere to stay in nearby Wembury. The lady of the family very kindly offers us the use of their guest bedroom. I detect that her husband is slightly less enthusiastic about the prospect of two random hikers staying in their house, and would like to tell you that this is the reason we politely decline. The truth, however, is that after discussing the matter, we both decide we were too scared. After leaving the pub, we're back on the trail and are soon making the short inland trek to Wembury. The afternoon is still warm and the sea radiates a silky, shimmering glow. When we arrive in the small, slightly nondescript village, we head straight for pub number 3 of the day. We've arrived later than expected, predominantly due to pubs number 1 and 2, and I realise I've only got 20 minutes to book into the village campsite before it closes. I leave Mickey B manly sipping a lime cordial and soda through a straw, and run as quickly as my aching limbs will allow. I reach it just in time and dump a few of my things before heading back to the pub. We order some dinner and talk a bit about the following day's walk. A few hours later, when I'm drunk and Mickey B is in the midst of a fully-fledged cordial-induced sugar rush, we head for the bus stop. After waving him goodbye and arranging where to meet the next morning, I amble up the road to the campsite, where I do a distinctly slapdash job of putting up the old tent. Stupid tent. I mean, seriously, what is the point? I know I've said it before, but this is absolutely the last time, Mr. Tent. I've had a few hours' broken sleep, and now here I am at the break of dawn, again attempting to shove endless miles of canvas into a bag that has definitely been swapped for a smaller one during the night. The temperature dropped in the early hours to, at most, -1,000 degrees, and I'm aching all over. It's several hours until I'm due to meet Mickey B, so I decide to slowly wander towards the beach in search of breakfast. I purchase something loosely approximating a Danish pastry from a newsagent and amble back down the road towards the water. That first sight of the sea has an increasing sense of profoundness with every passing day. A hitherto unrealised weight is lifted the moment my eyes rest upon the seductive waves. Be they silent and still, full of fury or boisterous and playful. The feeling is more pronounced each morning, and today my stroppy mood and tired lack of enthusiasm are washed away and replaced by a calm contentment. The sun is fully ablaze in the clear blue sky, and my spirits are on the up as I think about the 17-mile trek to Bantham that lies ahead of me. Whilst I'm waiting for Mickey B, I get chatting to a middle-aged lady out walking her dog, an elderly terrier that looks and moves as though it too must have spent an uncomfortable night under the canvas. We end up talking for a good 30 minutes or so. She tells me that she is a retired parole officer who has recently moved to this area to be near to her previously estranged son. Due to a difficult set of circumstances in her earlier life, she was left with no option but to put her child up for adoption. Many years later, she went looking for him, fearing an understandable but painful rejection, but finding instead a deep and lasting bond. It's all pretty emotional stuff, and by the time Mickey B's well-rested and cheery noggin appears, I'm not too far off having a case of the old quivering lip. I say goodbye and wish her all the very best, as Mickey B and I fall into step beside each other. The path is flat and easy in the run-up to the first of 3 ferry crossings during today's walk. During this opening 1-mile stretch, Mickey B delights in telling me how comfortable his night's rest has been, and shows little or no sympathy for my tale of woe and hardship. We make the ferry crossing by the skin of our teeth. For someone that walks at 1,000,000,000 miles an hour, he seems to have a knack for making me late for everything. The tiny boat takes us across the River Yelm to Nos Meo. From here, we join a wide track leading us through picturesque countryside strewn with beautiful ancient oak trees. We follow this track along the river, back towards the ocean in the warm sunshine. There are clouds beginning to gather overhead, but the sea remains quiet as the odd passing gull on surveillance duty glides by. The walking continues to be easy going as the path clings to low, grassy cliffs that roll gently down to meet the deep blue water. In the approach to Stoke Point a few miles later, the views become a touch more dramatic as the wind picks up and the waves begin to quietly crash into the now visible jagged rocks below us. Mickey B is in his element as he strolls quicker than I can run along the single file track. We chat about the possibility of a future long-distance trail together, possibly the Pennine Way. Somewhere around Bigbury Bay, the track enters an area of farmland and begins a stretch of steep climbs and slippery grassland descents. At the foot of one of these descents, and with one eye on the time, Mickey B turns back. We say our goodbyes and arrange another meet-up. He and Haley are going to join Tasha and our neighbour Paddy when they come and visit me in Brixham in a few days. Sophie and Dan will also join us there, so it should be a good old knees-up. I'm sorry to see the old sod go and stand and watch as he storms off at 1,000,000,000 miles an hour back down the path, quickly disappearing from view. A fellow insomniac, Mickey B is one of only 2 people I know, the other being my pops, that truly understands the need to be a sole moving dot on a vast open landscape. Alone again, I climb the next hill as the rain begins to lightly fall. A short while later, and the heavens have well and truly opened. I slip on a steep descent, fall on my backside and slide down a grassy verge. Covered in mud and soaked to the bone, I trudge on as the visibility worsens. For the second time in the last week or so, I'm amazed at how quickly and completely the weather can turn along this coastline. Later that afternoon, with the rain still pounding down, I reach the second crossing of the day at the River Irm. I need to cross this on foot, as it's too shallow for a boat crossing. I consult Rowley, who smugly points out that I needed to time my arrival here to just before or just after low tide. As I haven't done this, and have no idea what time low tide was or is, I walk along the river until I find a spot that looks shallow. I begin to unlace my boots when I decide that this is pointless, as every inch of me is soaked through already. I lift my oversized, overweight backpack above my head and bravely take the plunge. Initially, the water is only knee-high, and I sigh with relief as I begin to wade across to the other side. Somewhere around half distance, however, things take a turn for the worse, and the water is now at waist height. As the icy cold penetrates my nether regions and panic threatens to set in, I close my eyes, hope for the best, and keep going. The river reaches just above my belly before I eventually begin to rise again and press on into shallower waters. I reach the other side and sling down the backpack. I notice there is a couple watching me. Oh, good. I'm glad there was an audience for that. Who needs dignity anyway, right? They approach me and, trying not to laugh, check that I'm all right. I try my best to look cool. I aim to give the impression that I knew well in advance exactly how deep the river was and that I'm the sort of rugged adventurer that does this kind of thing on a daily basis. This may have been more convincing if I were able to stop shaking with cold. They kindly offered to drive me to my final destination for the day. I thank them but decline, and after emptying my boots and pointlessly wringing out my socks, I trudge comically on. The last stretch of the walk is mercilessly tough going. The rain continues as I clamber up ever more slippery hillsides and slide back down again. The scenery as I pass the jagged teeth at Westcombe Beach and then Aimer Cove is the coast path at its rugged best. I'm reminded of Hartland Point and the stormy beauty of North Devon, but in truth am in no fit state to fully appreciate it. I'm barely standing by the time I reach Bigbury-on-Sea and the majestic Berg Island. Ordinarily, I would have stopped at least a half a dozen times over the last few miles to soak up the beauty that surrounds me. Yet, as the rain continues to lash down, I'm motivated only by the prospect of the warm and dry pub that awaits me in Bantham. The pub is just over the River Avon, the third and final river of the day. I have, of course, missed the last ferry crossing and so end up taking an 8-mile taxi ride, the car eventually dropping me off 30 feet across the water from where it picked me up 15 minutes earlier. But I don't care. I'm elated to have made it to my accommodation for the evening. It has been a varied and at times spectacular trek from Wembury, and I feel as though the true essence of the trail has returned. The last memories of urban Plymouth seem to have been laid to rest. I spend the evening in front of the fire in the pub recovering, before retiring to a warm bed and a sound sleep. The next day begins with a straight choice between a still damp set of clothes or an absolutely eye-wateringly stinky set from the deepest, darkest depths of the backpack. I plump for the latter and almost instantly regret my decision. After dispensing with the chef's finest Weetabix and semi-skimmed, I step out into the blazing hot sunshine of the new day. The damp clothes would have dried in mere seconds, whereas the heat will further intensify the potency of the already honking garments as the day progresses. Even the gulls are keeping their distance as I rejoin the path. The walking is initially easy going as I pass through Thurlston. To complete the smelly Stig of the Dump motif, I'm soon encircled by my own entourage of tiny insects. They buzz around my head with frantic purpose, oblivious to my increasingly elaborate hand-waving protests. After several unpleasant minutes, the clouds of minuscule assassins clear just long enough for me to catch sight of Thurlston Golf Course sprawling out in front of me. I pass through the variety of warning signs as the early morning Argyle Brigade take care to avoid eye contact with the strange creature emitting the foul stench and putting them off their swing. Things improve dramatically as soon as I pass through the course, however. As the houses disappear from the landscape, the path begins to dip and climb, and the sea weighs up whether or not to muster any crashing waves to complete the ambience. Eventually it decides it's too much effort, and the remaining walk to Hope Cove is still and peaceful through the thickening heat haze. A kestrel hovers silently in front of me, searching for a mid-morning snack. Each time I get within a certain distance of it, the bird powers forward a few hundred yards to safety, then hovers once more. Initially, I assume this is merely a precautionary measure, but then wonder if my powerful odour has a 200-yard radius. After a short jaunt along a country lane, I arrive at the pretty fishing village of Hope Cove. The grass-covered rock clusters jutting out to sea contrast against the quaint cottages and very appealing country pub that sit behind the beachfront. The overall effect is strikingly attractive, and the height of the cliffs on either side give the whole thing a wonderfully secluded feel. The walking continues to slowly intensify as I leave Hope Cove, and the climbs become steeper and rockier. The views in both directions along this section are breathtaking. Even through the blur of the heat haze, I can see far into the distance as I break into a broad smile. Each time I get a view like this ahead of me on this trail, a childish excitement washes over me. I'm looking at the adventures of the next few days, a sneak preview. It dawns on me that when I started to walk, I was forever looking backwards, amazed at how far I'd travelled. But as the trip goes on, it's these forward vistas that bring me the most joy. This is especially true as I enter the final third of the journey, as it provides a welcome reminder that there is still so much to look forward to. The walking and scenery continue to deliver as I approach Bolt Head. The track thins as it clings to the hillside, and the sea remains eerily calm a few hundred feet below. My feet begin to ache, and the pack is feeling heavy on my back, but I'm walking at pace and with a raw enthusiasm. These last few miles between Hope Cove and Bolt Head have confirmed something I already knew to be true. The South Devon coast, at its best, is every bit as awe-inspiring and beautiful as that of North Devon or Cornwall. It's just not nearly as often that you come across these unspoilt sections on the south coast. The coastline here is far more densely populated and boasts many more affluent holiday spots. All wonderful places if that's your bag, but for the walker, places like Bolt Head show you a glimpse of how phenomenal it would once have been to walk this stretch. Speaking of affluent holiday spots, they don't come any more affluent than my destination for the night. Salcombe. The long roadside walk through the town, as well as drenching me in sweat in the hot late afternoon sunshine, allows me to gaze at the multi-million pound properties, high-class eateries and gigantic yachts and sailboats moored in the harbour. You know what they say. When in Rome, I have, somewhat recklessly, splashed out on the poshest hotel of the entire trip. I'm talking luxury spa retreat here. I'm in the cheapest room, of course, but there's cheap, and there's this really isn't cheap at all. I waft into the large foyer area, and, if I do say so myself, turn a few heads in the process. Nothing to do with my red-faced, sweaty appearance or penetrating odour, I'm sure. Memories of my first night in Porlock Weir come back to me as I'm hastily removed from public view and shown to my room. I peel off the old rags and relax for an hour or two in the jacuzzi bathtub. I then wander around the vast room in my fluffy dressing gown, sipping a single malt from the minibar whilst perusing the dinner menu. Having decided on the charred leeks and white asparagus with hazelnuts and milk skin, I clap on the lights, switch on the 50-inch HD flat screen and hop onto the four-poster waterbed for a well-earned siesta. People just don't realise how tough this nomadic lifestyle of the long-distance walker can be. Apparently the hotel is too posh to have Weetabix, so I'm forced to slum it the next morning with some eggs Florentine. Whilst I'm tucking in, a horrible elderly couple spend a full 20 minutes shouting at the lady serving breakfasts for having the nerve to request that they sit at any table in the whole restaurant other than the one by the door that hasn't yet been laid. The lady is apologetic and courteous to a fault, but they continue their ludicrous outburst, eventually asking to speak to the manager and generally behaving like spoilt children, probably golfers. I make sure I leave a message at reception saying how wonderful I thought the service at breakfast was and how well the lady dealt with the moronic snobs. That's just the kind of selfless and gallant act you can expect from me, dear reader. After donning the boots and backpack, I leave the hotel and head towards the road that will take me back to the path. I'm met by the very welcome sight of Pops and Tiny. They've made the long drive early in the morning to join me for one last hurrah.